Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Does an American political progressive in the 21st century have in common with a pagan of ancient Rome? More than you may think, according to law professor Stephen D. Smith. In his important provocative new book, Pagans and Christians in the City, Culture Wars from the Tiber to the Potomac, Smith shows that traditionalist Christians who oppose same-sex marriage and similar cultural developments feel themselves besieged by a triumphalist progressivism that increasingly is adopting a we won, they lost view of where society and public opinion now stand on issues such as abortion and euthanasia, and has little use for what it regards as passé notions about religious liberty. Smith, borrowing a term from T.S. Eliot, dubs this increasingly intolerant form of left-wing thinking modern paganism, and in his book, we learn how even the U.S. Constitution is being paganized by a left that regards the views of conservative Christians, in the words of the noted conservative legal and political philosopher Robert P. George, in his foreword to Smith's book, as not only unsound but unreasonable, outrageous, scandalous, even hateful. They can account for, if at all, only as religious irrationalism, bigotry, or as many today now claim, a psychopathology. Those are Robert George's words. Where do we stand these days when it comes to working out some kind of social-cultural modus vivendi between the diametrically opposed camps of modern paganism and Christianity, and not even, in many cases, the traditionalist version? Smith provides us with the historical background we need to understand where everyone involved is, so to speak, coming from. Give a listen. Hello, everyone. My name is Hope Lehman, and I'm one of the hosts of the New Books Network. I'm talking today with Stephen D. Smith, the author of the 2018 book, Pagans and Christians in the City, Culture Wars from the Tiber to the Potomac. Steve, before we get to who you are, let's get to the obvious question. What do you mean by pagan vis-a-vis 2020 American political and cultural life? While we are at it, could you please explain what you mean by eminent religiosity? That is a key concept in your book. Could you flesh it out for our listeners?
Sure, I'll try to. Those are big and difficult questions, so you're getting right to the heart of some of the difficult concepts in the book. As you noted already, I got the term pagan and began using it to describe what I'm doing from an essay or a set of lectures, actually, by T.S. Eliot, who said that basically the modern world in the West would be determined by a contest between Christianity and modern paganism. Now, that strikes a lot of people, I think, as a pretty implausible description of anything they see in the world today. I mean, there are probably self-describing pagans who, you know, engage in one or another sort of cult practice. But that doesn't seem to most people like a very accurate description of the politically and socially salient constituencies that we're talking about here, like progressives and so forth, and academics, certainly. So one of the challenges in the book was to explain why that term might be apt, despite people's suspicion of it. And the way I tried to do that was to talk about, first of all, what religion is, and that's a much disputed term, as you know. Mm-hmm. But it seemed to me that one way to approach that was to say that religion is kind of a commitment to some sort of sacred, to the holy, to the sacred, the idea that there is in reality something that's distinguishable from just secular or mundane reality that you could describe as holy. Then the next question would be, where does someone locate the holy? And a number of scholars that I've read suggest that in ancient Greece and Rome, in the world of antiquity, there was a lot of belief in gods, And there were lots of variations in the way in which people believed in those gods, whether they believed in them literally or more metaphorically and so forth. But that the gods were gods in and of this world. They weren't transcendent. They didn't, they didn't basically create the world. They were within the world. And then scholars like Jan Osman, the Egyptologist, argues that the distinctive thing about later Judaism and Christianity was that they believed in a transcendent God, a God who, and I've been reminded so many times of this point, is often within the world. Christianity certainly believes in an immanent God, indeed in an incarnate God, but a God who is ultimately transcendent, who was outside of the world, who created the world, and that this was a radical revolution, Osman and others suggest. So going from that suggestion, the fundamental distinction that runs through the book is between transcendent religiosity and immanent religiosity. And I understand in proposing that that's a very elusive distinction, both in the abstract and in trying to figure out how it works in concrete situations. Nonetheless, I follow a number of other scholars and theologians in thinking that it's an important distinction, that a lot has actually turned on it, however elusive it might be. So in that context, pagan basically is a label for immanent religiosity. And so that's how I'm using the term.
Well, that's very helpful. Now that you've tackled the incredibly abstruse things that might be, things are difficult for average readers, but I must say that for average readers, I'm an average reader, and your book is very approachable and very understandable. It just helps to have a little background on that particular concept because it is kind of difficult.
It has been for a lot of readers, I can tell you.
Yeah, I'll bet. Now, usually on the New Books Network, we ask the guest to speak about your professional background. So could you do that and how you came to write this book? And specifically, I'd like to mention that, ask who the intended audience in this. And I'd like to say in this regard that when I first became aware of the book by the very public praise of it by the conservative public intellectual Robert P. George of Princeton, who also wrote the foreword to the book. And yet, as I read the book, I kept thinking that progressives and others who are far from considering themselves conservative would also benefit immensely by reading it in order to gain a grasp of how their own beliefs have been informed by and are infused with centuries of tensions between pagan this worldism, which you've just discussed, and other faiths, particularly Christianity, that place their hopes in a world beyond this one, even while fighting for justice in this world. Am I right in saying that the book has as much to offer liberals as to conservatives?
Well, I would like to think so, and I certainly didn't want to write it just for conservatives or just for Christians or just for religious people in the traditional sense of religious. I'm actually I'm a law professor, and I mostly do write for academic audiences, but certainly not conservative or religious audiences, and that would be a pretty small audience in my world if I were to direct my work primarily at them. So I hope that's true. You began by asking something about my background, and I guess I've already said I'm not actually a historian, not a Roman historian or a historian of early Christianity, and I'm not really even a classicist. So this is a little bit of a different project for me. It was getting into this. I could tell you a little bit if you're interested about how I came to write this particular book, which is different than most of what law professors write or than what I've written in the past.
Oh, please do.
Okay, so I've written a lot about constitutional law over the years, some about legal philosophy, quite a lot about religious freedom. That's an area that has become, of great interest to a lot of people, and I've been working in that field for quite a long time. So naturally, I get involved in writing about that kind of a subject. Now, what happened in this case is that back in 2015, there was a brouhaha, you may remember, about a statute passed in the state of Indiana, a Religious Freedom Restoration Act, as it was
absolutely
called, in Indiana. And it really caused a commotion. And it was a lot of it was quite interesting because it was almost word for word identical to a statute that Congress had passed back in 1993 with virtually unanimous support across the political spectrum, a statute called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act that had been signed by Bill Clinton in a speech in which he praised it and said that religious freedom is the first of our liberties and we need to be willing to fight to the death to defend it and so forth. But a lot had changed in the intervening period. And so when Indiana passed a similar statute on the state level, it was denounced by pundits, politicians, boycotts were imposed and so forth. And eventually it was modified somewhat, you know, to try to escape the criticisms that had been made. Well, I had been asked to write just basically a blog post for a kind of religious freedom website about that. And in the course of doing it, I was trying to find a different angle on it. Academics usually try to do that. That would make my post a little bit, you know, a little more interesting, not just the mundane thing. And so I had happened to be reading this book by T.S. Eliot, or rereading it. I had read it some years earlier, in which he talked about the contest between paganism and Christianity. And so I put a little a paragraph, I think, about that, you know, from the book into the blog post. And one person who happened to be visiting at our school at the time, a somewhat noted character and academic, Stanley Fish, you may know, told me that he thought the post was interesting and that the Eliot part was the most interesting aspect of it. So it occurred to me that's something that could be developed. So even though, as I say, I'm not a Roman historian or a classicist, I began sort of doing more work on that, more research. It was fascinating reading. For me, it was a great break from just reading boring contemporary law review articles. and the book is what came out of that. And as you know, from having read it, it has more on ancient history, or the history of, let's say, in late antiquity, Roman and Christian history, than it has probably on contemporary history, although it does have several chapters trying to apply you know, what I get out of the ancient history to our contemporary situation.
Well, getting back to the history aspect of it, you do mention, for those of us who don't know Augustine very well, could you discuss the meaning of the word "the city" in your title? Could you please elaborate on that and how that reflects on the book and what that deals with?
Yeah, I'll try to do that. City, you know, is, I guess, sort of a metaphor. You know, Augustine's probably most famous and important book. He wrote a lot, but probably his most revered book is The City of God. Mm. The full title is, I think, at least sometimes is listed as City of God Against the Pagans. And when Augustine in the book talks about two cities, you know, the City of God and the City of Man. And city in that sense refers not to some particular city like Rome or, you know, Athens, but rather to sort of, let's say, the human society and polity, something of that sort. Human beings, but, you know, in our social political relations with each other, and the city of God is sometimes identified with the church, but that's not a good identification. You know, the church would be sort of like an institutional representation of the city of God, but the city of God would be more, you know, the heavenly city reflecting, again, the communion of saints, let's say, and, you know, our relations with God and each other considered in under the aspect of our love of God and faith in God. So it's meant to be to indicate that this is not just pagans and Christians in general. I'm considering their social and political dimensions. I think let's focus on that. And so that lends itself to tying this into current constitutional law and so forth. So that's sort of what I mean, trying to use the term in basically the same way I think Augustine used it.
Okay, and then T.S. Eliot basically broadened it out to Western civilization. He talked about a Christian society. There was a stark choice. I believe that the lectures were 1939 or?
Yes.
And he talked about the choice that was facing the world between, or facing the West, between remaining a Christian society, even though he was ambivalent about whether it actually was, I believe, and giving in to modern paganism. Could you discuss what Eliot's view of where he was at the time, and or even it wasn't even historically situated, right? He's just speaking about Christian society over the eons.
Well, yes, I mean he gave the lectures at Cambridge in 1939. No doubt he was aware of sort of looming fascism and so forth and the existence of communism, and the paganism may have had some reference to those sorts of possibilities. And he talked about Western societies having to make that choice. And he was ambivalent, I suppose, about whether Western societies are Christian societies. I think he says specifically that they're Christian societies, but not in any robust sense. Mm. He says basically they're Christian societies by default, in the sense that they were once Christian societies. And he said, and they remain Christian societies until they become positively something else. And he didn't think they had become at that point positively something else. A bit more in a sort of a confused no man's land, I think is the way he saw it. And so he figured, again, sort of by default, they were Christian societies. In the book, I say kind of much in the way that somebody under the law is treated as a domiciliary of some place where they had citizenship until they establish a domicile somewhere else, even if they haven't been in that place for decades. You know, I think that's the way Eliot was thinking of ours as being Christian societies. And yeah, I think he did think that there was something that he described as modern paganism that was looming as a potential kind of replacement, the positively something else that might make them no longer Christian societies. So for me, that was a good takeoff point for the kinds of questions I wanted to consider. Beyond that, I don't really do much with Eliot's specific thought, you know, and all the specific contents of his essay. It's more, as I say, more of a takeoff point, but I think it's a very suggestive one and kind of a helpful one. I mean, Eliot says at the beginning of the lectures, he's proposing this somewhat unusual idea because he thinks it will help clarify things that the way in which we are thinking about things today often just produces more confusion than illumination. And I often have that sense also about the modern categories that get used over and over of religious versus secular. I mean, I think we try to understand movements and politics and so forth in those religious versus secular terms. And often that just sort of sheds more darkness than light. So following Eliot, I thought it might be more illuminating to think of these things as competing religiosities more than, you know, secular as a non-religious thing and religion. And so that's what the book tries to explore.
Well, speaking of religiosities and how you classify things, I'm going to ask you a question. I'm going to ask you now to respond to some comments by a critic of your book, if you don't mind, to see how that gives you a chance to respond. To wit, David Delbertson, associate professor at the University of Southern California, writing in the left-wing Catholic magazine Commonweal, accuses you of making an elementary mistake, one that anyone with even a cursory knowledge of Christianity, he says, can see. He thinks you associate in a very simple-minded way, you know, his lovely way of putting things, Christianity with divine transcendence and paganism with the idea that the divine is immanent in the world. And how would, before you respond, I would just say that in his foreword to your book, Robert George seems to anticipate this objection of people like Albertson and shows what's wrong with their objections. George says that you do not overlook the fact that Christianity and Judaism, while understanding God as transcendent, also see God as active and in that sense immanent in the affairs of the world. In Christianity, God even becomes incarnate, enters the world as a human being. So how would you address Albertson's criticisms?
Yeah, he actually presented a paper from which that article was derived at a conference that I attended last summer, I guess, or about almost a year ago. And so I was familiar with it, and I thought it was a interesting paper, and he presented it in a charitable spirit and so forth. So this is the kind of engagement, really, that I think is welcome, you know, in the academy. A couple things I would acknowledge right from the first. One is, as Robert George mentioned in the foreword, I tried to say over and over again that Christianity is not just a purely transcendent religion. You know, Christianity not only thinks that God is active in the world, but is kind of distinctive in saying that God actually became a human being, you know, was born as a baby, went through, you know, all of the aspects of mortality, you know, suffered pain, was killed, and resurrected, of course, in the Christian view. But it's true that Christians believe in that, and that a lot of that was scandalous to pagans. Not the idea that God might come down and assume human form, because Greek and Roman gods did that, obviously, from time to time, but that God would actually suffer himself to be killed, you know, crucified, mistreated, and so forth. That was scandalous. And so even from early drafts of the book, people would point that out to me. Christianity is not just a transcendent religion. And I try to be clear and acknowledge that point a number of times in the book. So I will admit that I find it just slightly annoying when people say that I didn't acknowledge that. But the other thing I'll acknowledge is that, once again, terms like transcendent and immanent get used in different ways. And so I think Albertson says, well, the Greek gods were transcendent. Well, I suppose in some senses they were transcendent. I mean, they were superior to human beings. They were immortal. You know, it's not too surprising that someone might use the adjective transcendent for things like that. Nonetheless, a number of scholars, I think, indicate that in a somewhat more technical sense, the Greek and Roman gods were not transcendent. They were immanent gods. They were within this world. Yeah, this is not only scholars, but for example, I think I quote the Jewish rabbi and I think very profound thinker, Abraham Heschel, you know, who points out that the way he puts it is that the Greek gods were the Greeks worship nature, you know, and God within nature, and that biblical man, as he puts it, did not do this, you know, saw a God beyond nature and so forth and worshiped a God beyond nature. And I think that's true for Christianity as well. Now, just one further point here. It is definitely true that within the Christian tradition, the nature of God, obviously, and the connection or relations between transcendence and immanence have been ongoing subjects of reflection. And different Christian thinkers will emphasize one or another aspect of God. Some will emphasize transcendence. Some will emphasize immanence. I think it's true that particularly in modern times, let's say Christian thinkers that are sometimes described as modernist or liberal strongly emphasize the immanence as opposed to the transcendence, sometimes almost to the exclusion of the transcendence. I mean, this was a way, I think, for them of trying to reconcile Christianity with a lot of modern development, science and modern politics and progressivism and so forth. So that when someone like Professor Albertson says Christianity is basically distinctive just because it's an immanent religion, I think that is a mistake historically, but I think it is, let's say, very much in line with the sort of modernist tendency to emphasize the immanence of God. And I would think, I didn't do it, and I would have to do a lot more work in order to do it if I could, but you could add another chapter to the book talking about, well, to put it provocatively, let's say, the paganization of Christianity with an emphasis on immanence, you know, as the essence of Christian worship. And I do think that is a sort of a tendency in the direction of the sort of modern paganism. And perhaps, I don't really know his background or all of his views, it may be that Professor Albertson is sort of in that movement. As I say, I can't say for sure, but what he said there sounded to me like something that resonates with that way of trying to understand Christianity.
Okay, well, that answers the Albertson issue very well. Moving to the contemporary issue, and of course your book does address the modern political scene and how all these issues play out on the socio-cultural stage. Could you tell us about Laycock's question and how you address it in very question, that is Laycock's question, and how you address it in various sections of your book, and how it relates to ongoing court cases that we've all read about involving bakers, florists, and other small business owners and their relations with same-sex couple, would-be, or existing customers?
Yeah, so Doug Laycock is one of the leading scholars and sometimes litigators of religious liberty today, I think, and he's somebody that I sometimes agree with, sometimes disagree with, but I admire him very much. I think he's done really good work, both scholarly work and you know, more legal and litigating work. Doug is a, well, at least according to a description he gave some years back, I don't know if this reflects his current thinking, but he describes himself as an agnostic, and he's pretty libertarian, it seems to me, in his overall leaning. So he's someone who thinks and has been saying for a long time that there ought to be some perfectly acceptable compromise in some of these culture war issues. And more specifically, well before Obergefell, I think Doug recommended that we ought to accept same-sex marriage and so forth. The law ought to respect some of the, let's say, the sexual morality resulting from the sexual revolution, not try to regulate sexuality and so forth. But also that there ought to be ample accommodation for religious freedom. I think in Doug's view, and he's hardly alone in this, I mean, there are other people who basically share this view, we should just be able to live and let live. And that seems like an attractive possibility. And it's frustrating, I think, to Doug and to people, you know, who view things that way, that people on both sides of the culture war issues don't seem to be willing to accept that. That, as he says, everybody seems to want a total victory. They want to crush the others and so forth. So that's, I think, what I describe as Laycock's question. You know, why is it that people on both sides of the divide don't seem willing to just accept that sort of live and let live view, the way he understands it, at least, that ought to be possible? And I think that's a question that is a modern version of the same kind of question that could be raised in late antiquity, because it seemed, as I suggest in one of the chapters, to both Christians and pagans in the late Roman Empire, that there ought to be some way in which they should just be able to get along well enough. Christians like Tertullian, you know, argued, say, you know, we're good citizens. We support the emperor. We pray for the emperor. We pretty much associate with the Romans in almost all the activities of life. But just because we believe in certain things, you're always persecuting us, and sometimes in very severe ways, of course. And there were Romans, I think, on the other side of the issue, who also thought that it should be really quite easy to get along. All we're really asking of the Christians is that they acknowledge, you know, the emperor's deity, throw some incense on the, you know, on the altar or something, nothing very hard. They should be able to do that. So it seemed to people on both sides at that time that there should be some live and let live situation that would be perfectly acceptable to both sides. And I try to explain in one of the chapters of the book how, however appealing that position might have been, it really wasn't a viable one. That people on both sides were misunderstanding what was at stake and misunderstanding the way in which their views actually did commit them to things that were fundamentally incompatible with the views of people on the other side.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, I know that you, I just want to interrupt to say at this point, I just want to remind listeners that we're talking today with Stephen D. Smith, the author of the book, Pagans and Christians in the City, Culture Wars from the Tiber to the Potomac. I'm sorry to have interrupted you, Steve. I just wanted to mention that you really talk fascinatingly about the book, about the fact that the Romans or the pagans basically regarded the Christian insistence on sexual continence and marital fidelity as not only irksomely constraining, but as bizarre and unhealthy and unfathomable. They just could not grasp why a man should not lead a sexual life as free as he wanted to, or as the woman stayed at home and was chaste and so forth.
Yes. I think that was true. I mean, not only was the Christian position restrictive, you know, in the pagan view, but it was unhealthy, and not just in a sort of a mundane psychological sense, but there was something about it that was almost incomprehensible because in the pagan view, sexuality, you know, and let's say sexual relations were, I think Kyle Harper, the historian, describes it as something like a manifestation of the imminent indwelling of the divine. I'm not sure if I've quoted him exactly, but, you know, there's something actually quite divine or sacred about sexual relations that the Christian view seemed not to accept and so forth. So there was a fundamental difference in understanding there. And I think something similar to, parallel to that, that difference again exists in current cultures, which is again one reason why sexuality and issues related to sexuality like abortion, marriage, contraception, and so forth are at the core of culture war issues today. That, you know, that was central to the differences then, and it remains central to the differences now.
Well, absolutely. I was going to ask that in terms of modern paganism, that when people have kind of a rosy view of how wonderful everything was, the state of sexual freedom and liberation in the pagan era, but it was pretty bad. It was pretty awful for women. And I just want to ask, in terms of modern paganism, that is, we've seen some pretty dire consequences of this freewheeling sexual revolution, with the consequences for women and young girls, as we saw in the Harvey Weinstein and Jeffrey Epstein cases. Would you consider those men sort of modern pagans and sort of poster boys for the whole pagan culture?
Well, I guess I can't really judge anybody in particular, but I would say that the sort of prevailing sexual morality that we associate with the sexual revolution and that we see, I think, exemplified just pervasively and television, movies, all kinds of media and so forth, has a lot of resemblance to the sort of pagan view of sexuality in late antiquity. I mean, there are definitely differences. And one of the differences that you've kind of alluded to is that the ancient Roman view was very self-consciously a sort of double standard view. You know, the for men, the sort of sexual norms were totally different than they were for women. And that was one of the reasons why it could be quite oppressive, because the practice of that kind of sexuality depended then pervasively on slavery and prostitution, you know, as the main avenues of sexual expression for men. And in some of those respects, I think the norms today are really quite different. You know, it would be much more, today would be much more egalitarian and so forth. But the basic idea of sexuality is essentially, today we insist on the sort of consenting nature of it, but and obviously people like Harvey Weinstein and so forth, you know, have not respected that norm, but as a basically healthy and indeed kind of a manifestation of the highest, or something that's almost sacred, that has almost a sacral or religious quality, I think that is actually similar today to, you know, what the understandings were in ancient Rome.
Well, yeah, I'd like to ask, continuing on another topic, you mentioned that there were other aspects. It wasn't just the sexual continence issue that puzzled and bewildered and angered, really infuriated the pagans about the Christians. Was there were other aspects, and you talked about there were certain things that, can't we all get along? But the Christians said, no, this is fundamental to us. We can't just get along by sacrificing animals and so forth, and we have one God and so forth. What were some of the practices of the Christians besides fidelity and marriage that just upset and really just maddened to an extent that drew just a wrath of heaven down upon, I mean, the wrath of and really savage, yeah, reprisals. What were some of the things that Christians did? I mean, you said, well, we pay our they would argue we pay our taxes, we obey the law. What is it? Why can't you just give us a break here?
Yes. So, I will try to answer that question. Although I guess I should say, just for clarification at the beginning, it's not true that the Roman authorities were engaged in constant persecution of Christians.
That's, you know,
there,
true.
There were
That's
many true. Places and many funny. Times in which they did manage to get along, or, you know, relatively peacefully. There were, waves of repression from time to time, and they were quite severe in many cases. But just to make it clear, it wasn't like an ongoing, steady persecution of Christians.
Yes, I think you make that very clear in your book. I'm sorry to misrepresent it, because you do say that it was intermittent oppression, and
exactly.
It was for they would be surprisingly tolerant at times.
Right. Mm-hmm. But I also guess I say that insofar as they were tolerant, insofar as they get along, managed to get along quite well much of the time, in part that probably did reflect a failure to understand the real commitments, you know, of the opposing positions. Because the Christian position was, yes, we believe, in fact, our scripture teaches us that we're supposed to support earthly authorities, and we can support the emperor and so forth, but we can't accept the emperor as divine. We can't, you know, let's say Christians obviously differed in practice on this, but let's say committed Christians thought, you know, we can't sacrifice to the emperor accepting the emperor as divine. And in fact, we are obligated to teach the truth of our more monotheistic religion, which pagans, I think, correctly perceived was subversive of the ethic and the cultural basis, you know, of pagan authority. So in doing that, insofar as they did that, the Christians, however much they may have thought in their own minds that we're happy to support Roman authorities, were in reality subversive. In that respect, I think the pagans were correct to perceive that. And on the other side, some pagans, I think, would have been quite happy to accept Christianity and accept Jesus, for example, as one among the gods. I mean, there was already a large pantheon of gods, and it wouldn't have hurt to, you know, add another deity to the pantheon. And some Roman emperors, even Alexander Severus, apparently put a statue of Jesus in his private chapel, along with statues of other, you know, of other divine divinities or divine persons and so forth. And you can understand, I think, how from a pagan point of view, that would have seemed very tolerant, and the Christians would have seemed very unreasonable to refuse that sort of what would have seemed like reciprocity. You know, we'll accept your God if you'll accept our gods. Why can't we all just get along?
Absolutely. We will not be co-opted.
The live and let live position. Absolutely. But the Christians, to accept Jesus, you know, as one God among many, was essentially to deny Jesus as the, you know, as the divine person that they understood him to be. And so from their point of view, this was not a live and let live situation. This was a sort of a proposition of, we'll accept you if you will sacrifice your essential faith and accept ours.
Well, yes, I'd like to follow up on that in terms of drawing a parallel to the modern era. You make a fascinating case that just as pagans in the classical worlds tried to, for example, to make it difficult for Christians to operate in the marketplace, because if you will not be co-opted, then we'll marginalize you, seem to be sort of the soft power aspect of the Roman rule. But this same tactic in terms of trying to marginalize Christians and Christianity, it seems that zealous progressives in our own time, they like to, sometimes they not all, but some of them target small business owners who for religious reasons feel they cannot in good conscience, for example, provide services in same-sex wedding ceremonies, even they're happy to provide services to homosexual clients in every other respect, but they will not, there are certain that they will not get, will not provide that particular service. And the, even though the customer could get it elsewhere, there's just this kind of endless tug of war between, I will not do that for you, but I will do this for you, and you must do this for me because this is the civic norm, and I will sue you and I will bankrupt you if you don't. And it's, could you comment on this historical line between the economic power of the pagan in the past and the modern pagan now?
Yes. So if I can start again with, say, late antiquity, mm-hmm. I think it's fair to say that in basically the 4th century going into the 5th century, there came to be a kind of struggle between Christianity and paganism for essentially to define what the empire was. You know, would it be a pagan empire? Would it be a Christian empire? This wasn't an overt struggle at all times, but, you know, looking back on it, you can see, you know, that this sort of struggle was going on. And one of the main ways in which this occurred was as part of a kind of a contest for control of the essential symbols that constituted the empire. There's, you know, a famous book about imagined communities that suggests that communities, a political community exists not as a physical fact, but as something that we imagine. We conceive of ourselves as belonging to a community and to a community of a particular kind.
That's Benedict Anderson?
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And public symbols are one of the important markers or, you know, factors in sort of supporting those imaginings and thus in constituting the political community as the particular kind of community that it was. So there was, for example, one of the more dramatic, interesting, I think, incidents was a contest in late antiquity over something that was called the Altar of Victory. It was a pagan altar that was put outside the Senate House in Rome. It had been put there by the Emperor Augustus, and it was clearly a pagan symbol. Constantius, Constantine's son, when he became emperor, was a Christian emperor, not Orthodox, but, you know, a Christian emperor, and he had the pagan symbol removed, the Altar of Victory removed. Later, Julian, the emperor who attempted a restoration of paganism, had it restored. Later, another Christian emperor, Gratian, had it removed again. A senator, Symmachus, who was a pagan, made an eloquent plea to have it restored, which the powerful bishop of Milan, Ambrose, stoutly resisted. And one modern historian says, well, it's hard to understand why the people could have so much passion about a harmless piece of furniture. But I suggest that it wasn't a harmless piece of furniture. It was a constitutive symbol, and everybody involved understood that this is one of the symbols that helps us to create and imagine and constitute the empire as a political community that's Christian or that's pagan. So I think that a lot of the contemporary struggles now over symbols, you mentioned crosses and things of that sort, are basically, again, understandable largely as reflecting that kind of a contest, you know, over what kind of political community do we belong to. People on both sides will say something like, well, who cares that much about a cross? I mean, it doesn't really hurt anybody. It doesn't cost any money. People on both sides, why do they care that much about it? But I'm suggesting the people on both sides are a little bit more perceptive than that, and they understand that these kinds of symbols are constitutive of the kind of community that we live in. So I think the same is true in the wedding vendor cases that you were asking about. Someone might say, why does anybody care that much that one baker or one florist doesn't want to do a same-sex wedding when there are plenty of other bakers and plenty of other florists? And sometimes these arguments get people try to cash them out in terms of, yeah, but it might be that they'd have a hard time, you know, finding another baker or another florist. Well, you can imagine circumstances in which that could be true, but that hasn't been true in any of the actual controversies. And I think it's hard to deny that something else is going on there. And what's going on, I would suggest again, is that religious freedom and issues about same-sex marriage, because they're right at the divide between, again, the sort of more Christian and the more eminently religious or progressive or pagan, if I can use the word, sort of views of the polity and of life. These are important symbols, and I think that's why people struggle about them and see correctly, I believe, that there is significance in these kinds of issues. That's my interpretation, anyway.
Well, I think that doesn't Laycock make the point that not only is it, as you say, it's not just about the cake, but it's going to be, we don't want you even to do business. We want to make sure that you can't even operate in the marketplace, period. You know, it's not enough that you don't, that I'm going to sue you. It's that your business will be crushed. You will be no longer allowed to be a baker, period.
Yeah. I mean, as you mentioned, not everybody takes that view, of course, but definitely some of the, some of the more sort of stalwart advocates and participants in these debates take that position. And quite openly, I think, you know, it's, to someone like Jack Phillips, the Colorado baker, say, we're not telling you you can't be a Christian. We're just saying, if you're going to be a Christian, you can't be a baker of the kind, you know, you need to find some other way to make a living and so forth. And some other ways so that, you know, you can be Christian as long as you keep it sort of private and not part of the marketplace in the public sphere in the way that you're trying to do. Once again, I think you can understand that motivation in terms of the symbolic significance.
Well, yes, you're right that pagans often consider in terms of the get along aspect that the pagans consider Christians, in your words, to be inflexible, dogmatic, and undeserving of accommodation, that we're not going to do that for you, in other words. But
And of course, someone like Laycock would say you see that attitude on both sides of the divide. And I think you sort of do. I just think I interpret that a little different than he does. It's not just sort of some kind of irrational stubbornness or desire to, you know, defeat the other side so much as an understanding that these are public symbols that help constitute our community as one kind of thing or another kind of thing. And that matters a lot. That's not unimportant.
It's not unimportant when the terms of, it's not just same-sex marriage, but it's also the fact that in order to do business, you must, the more zealous of the left would say, not only do you have to provide the cake, you have to provide health insurance that covers abortion, and you have to provide contraception related, even though, again, the woman could probably get that, all of those services from her own salary. I don't, you know, it's that you must provide that particular thing or you're not part of the state. You're not showing allegiance to the state. And wasn't that a common criticism by pagans of Christians that you're not showing sufficient allegiance or patriotism, or you're suspect for those very reasons, that you're not kowtowing to the certain, as you say, constitutive elements of this, of citizenship.
Well, I think you're sort of alluding now to something like the Hobby Lobby litigation that was extremely controversial. Hobby Lobby, a business owned by basically a very small group of people who are dedicated Christians, I think, and define their business vocation in Christian terms, didn't want to provide insurance coverage that would include contraceptives that they considered to be abortifacients. They weren't opposed to contraception in general, but there were certain contraceptives that they regarded as producing abortion. And so that was just one of the cases the Supreme Court eventually took, but generated a great deal of controversy. Now, to be fair, I think it would be wrong to say that there were only symbolic issues there. I mean, something like that presumably does have some real impact on people and so forth. Nonetheless, it did seem as if there was sort of an insistence on one side that not only should this sort of insurance coverage be provided, but we really want it provided by the employer. You know, you can look at that and see, you know, there was an, so when the Supreme Court suggested that the government actually could have achieved the same goal in a different way by treating for-profit corporations like Hobby Lobby in the same way that nonprofit religious corporations were treated, there was a great deal of opposition to that. And I don't want to oversimplify it. I mean, it's complicated. But one of the motivations that you may discern in that and that I discern is that we want the employer to acknowledge the public norm here. So if you interpret it that way, at least, then you can see again something is similar to the ancient attempt to say, if you want to participate in the marketplace, you need to acknowledge the deities, or we might say today, the egalitarian progressive public norms that may be inconsistent with at least what many Christians, you know, think their faith teaches.
Yeah, I think that you make the point in the book that the pagans would realized, as you say, that the Christians actually were a threat to many ideals of the Roman Empire. And one of the ways that they tried to tamp down the Christian influence was to forbid them from teaching. And that is somewhat similar to what's happening in some respects with modern paganism, that there it seems increasingly difficult, unless you adhere to the tenets of modern paganism, that it's very difficult to get a job in teaching. It's difficult. It's increasingly difficult to remain in pharmacy or medicine or commerce generally. Is that just, do you see that happening at all? Or,
I mean, somewhat, you know, there's obviously room to disagree. I mean, I do sort of suggest that there's been a movement in that direction. You know, the pharmacy, the drugstores in Washington who didn't want to dispense abortifacients, and basically, you know, there were the state cracked down on them. You know, these wedding vendor cases, areas of abortion and so forth. I'll raise these issues. I don't want to oversimplify too much because, let's say, I work in the academy.
That's right.
A lot of people that are my friends that I respect, I don't think they're in bad faith and so forth, you know, would disagree about a lot of some of them would disagree about some of these things and so forth. There are a lot of different views and so forth. They can't all be reduced to one view. Nonetheless, if you sort of step back and try and look at the overall direction of things, let's say, so if we went back to the 1950s, you can say most of the legal norms relative to sexuality reflected at least sort of residual Christian or biblical type views. Abortion was illegal most places. Contraceptives were regulated most places. Obscenity, you know, was regulated. Marriage was, you know, one person, you know, one man, one woman. On the books, this was probably hardly ever enforced, but there were even laws against fornication and adultery and so forth. So the public norms as reflected on the books were pretty much Christian norms. Today, that's almost completely reversed, I would say, you know, partly through legislation. A lot of this has happened through Supreme Court decisions and so forth.
Well, speaking of that, if you don't mind, I'd like to read a bit from your book about the Supreme Court and have you comment on what you actually said in the book, if that's all right.
Sure.
You wrote, beginning in the, and this is about the sort of, well, it speaks for itself. So I'll let you speak for itself. It says, beginning in the mid-1980s, the court explicitly began to articulate doctrine in terms of a constitutional prohibition on public messages of endorsement of religion. Likewise, you write, in their campaign to eliminate the transcendent dimension of American public religiosity, I cut a little bit, the courts have in effect pushed our official conceptions of our political community in an imminent or pagan direction. So I'd like to ask, what were the origins of this development? What have been the ramifications of this, say, in the recent decades? And who were the justices most notable in this shift?
Okay, first of all, the origins, what you mentioned first. Well, that, you know, that's complicated and arguably goes back a long ways. I argue in the book that although Christianity prevailed in late antiquity over paganism as sort of an official matter, that it was always complicated, and paganism in one form or another kind of remained actually a very important component of, you know, Western societies and so forth. So my argument in the book is that what's happened is not so much that, you know, paganism has been revived from nothing, but that a paganism that was always there in, you know, taking different forms and so forth, has, let's say, made an effort in recent decades to cast off the vestiges of the sort of official Christianity that had persisted for centuries. So the origins, I would say, go way back. And then do you want to say, you know, but in modern times, there's been a sort of more aggressive, I talk about it almost as a, I think as a counter-revolution, sort of a pagan counter-revolution, trying to throw off the Christian revolution of the fourth and fifth centuries. When did that start? You know, with these sorts of questions, it's, you know, say, yeah, well, you can see definitely a beginning here. And then someone can say, yeah, but you can see an earlier antecedent to that. And trying to figure out when it really started is very hard. But I do think, you say, in the 1960s with the sexual revolution, if you had to look to some sort of a, you know, watershed point or a marker, that would stand out, I think, as a time when things really began to change, you know, significantly. And that's continued, I think. Now, let's see, who on the passage that you read from the book, I mentioned that in the mid-1980s, the court began to say that the Establishment Clause of the Constitution, the First Amendment's Establishment Clause, prohibits government from doing or saying things that send a message endorsing religion. And that is when the court began to say that. That, however, was part of a more general movement, I would say, of, let's say, overthrowing the more Christian constitutional norms that would have begun earlier. There, if you wanted to pick a particular decision as one that suggested real change, well, two, I guess I would say. The school prayer decisions of the early 1960s, I think, were very important in this respect. And Griswold against Connecticut, the mid-1960s contraception case, reflect, I think, a significant change here in which the court's beginning to interpret the Constitution to basically forbid Christian norms, you know, to exclude Christian norms as public norms of governance. You know, again, not to deny that they can exist in private, but as public norms of governance, there's a big change there. And by now, that's been largely consummated, I think. So you can see this, I think, if you just think about something like, well, Abraham Lincoln's second inaugural address, which, in my view, is probably the most profound statement ever made by any sort of American public official or, you know, or politician. And it's just overtly religious and unapologetically so. I mean, it's biblical. It has repeated references to God. Under sort of modern thinking identified, let's say, associated with, say, John Rawls and the notion of public reason, that whole thing is somewhat suspect. And Rawls strains to explain why Lincoln's second inaugural address wouldn't be completely impermissible under his thinking, and, you know, and the explanations that he comes up with are not particularly convincing. But nonetheless, his position, I think, something like it, whether people have read Rawls or not, is by now widely accepted. So if you take something like the controversy over same-sex marriage, there were a lot of cases before Obergefell that litigated that issue, obviously. And in most of those cases, under either due process or equal protection constitutional doctrines, basically states that wanted to defend traditional marriage laws were required to show that they had some significant interest in maintaining these laws. And they usually tried unsuccessfully to discharge that burden by arguing that traditional marriage was good for families and good for children and so forth. And the courts tended to reject that. What they never did was actually say, people in our community or in our state actually have a view of marriage that's informed by their religious conceptions, and we think we have a right to reflect that in our laws. It was just sort of understood, I think, by everybody concerned that that wasn't an argument that you could make. You know, if you were to say that, your case would just be doomed. But at many earlier periods in American history, there would have been, I think, nothing surprising about that. You know, you know, that would have been part of the repertoire of argument and rhetoric, you know, that Americans would have engaged in. The Bible says this, or, you know, the Supreme Court said as late as 1952, we're a religious people whose institutions presuppose a supreme being. So there's just been, I think, an obvious and dramatic change in that respect, where ideas and arguments that were once perfectly permissible and natural are now thought to be totally out of bounds, just assumed to be out of bounds. You know, my law students or lawyers, you know, it just wouldn't occur to them that they could make that, because they understand, you know, that's not permissible in today's climate. And that, I think, is a reflection of this sort of change that I've been trying to describe and understand.
Well, I thought your reading of your discussion of Rawls's very tortured trying to read out the religiosity of Lincoln's writings and speeches was quite funny, because you just made it sound like that Rawls was just determined to strip any religious feeling out of Lincoln's thought, and in a very unconvincing way that you really outlined very well. You mentioned John Rawls, and I wanted to ask a follow-up question to another scholar you mentioned, Robin West, who I had not heard of. And it's interesting to me that it seemed that her ideas differ from Rawls, because she has this idea of shared values. And it seems that what Rawls wants to just exclude religious input from into public debate, West seems to sort of, to my view, sort of disingenuously welcome religious people into public debate and allow them to operate in the economy, provided that they adopt what her values are and renounce most of their own values. It just seems like, oh, well, you're perfectly welcome to engage in civic discourse as long as you understand the parameters of the left that exists now. And that's kind of the winner take all of the left at this point by Mark Touchnet and so forth. Could you address Robin West's view?
Yeah, first of all, on Rawls, I mean, I think Rawls, you know, was trying to do something that is difficult to do and important. It's a very legitimate thing, and that is to come up with some way in which, among people of very different views, we can nonetheless have a sort of mutually respectful polity. And he tried to do it, I think, by elaborating some notion of public reason that would, he modified his position over the years and so forth, and he tried to introduce provisos, for example, that would allow for a certain amount of religious discourse. But basically the idea is, you know, we should bracket our comprehensive views, including, for example, Christian views and so forth, when we're engaging with major political decisions, major political issues, and kind of talk within a more area of overlapping consensus in which we sort of share beliefs. And it does have the effect of excluding, to some degree or another, you know, religious reasons from influencing public discourse. But I think he did want it to be something that everybody, you know, in his view, would be able to participate in. That, I think, again, is sort of a modern reflection of the same kind of error, in my view, that pagans made when they thought that we're perfectly willing to accept Christians as long as they'll just engage in this reciprocal discourse and so forth. They'll respect our gods and we'll respect theirs, not understanding that just wasn't something that was consistent with the Christian view. My view is that in the end, Rawls's public reason kind of has that same effect. But I think he, you know, was trying to make room for conversation. Now, Robin West, I think, was less concerned about regulating the public discourse. But the part of the book that where I invoke her, she's disagreeing with recent decisions that would do things like respect free exercise exemptions. She thinks of those as allowing people to exit from the political community, which she describes repeatedly as, you know, our shared values, our values of fairness and justice and so forth. And to me, to my mind, the motivation may be good, but the description is just pretty unbelievable. And say our shared values mean basically your values.
So yeah, exactly. There's my way or the highway sort of thing.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, and on that, another thinker that I guess we are getting towards the end of the conversation, which I'm very much enjoying, but I wanted to ask about Ronald. You talk about how paganism is surging once again. One of the reasons for that is that it's pretty undemanding. I mean, when you talk about Ronald Dworkin, and he has sort of this quasi spiritual, sort of gauzy view of, well, we can all be sort of spiritual without having any actual content in our or any religious comprehensive doctrine kind of thing. Could you discuss Ronald Dworkin's view, how he plays into all of this?
Yeah. So Dworkin is someone that I discuss at some length in one of the chapters as an example of this tendency, I think, to an immanent religiosity. Dworkin was maybe the most important English-speaking legal philosopher of the last generation or two. And he was pretty resolutely secular, I think, in almost all of his writing. But he was always straining to come up with some ground for, you know, for categorical rights or categorical moral commitments. And in his last book, he called it Religion Without God. And he it's something in the lines of along the lines of Spinoza and Einstein, and he claims Paul Tillich, at least, you know, a kind of a religion that doesn't depend upon any affirmation of a transcendent deity or anything of that sort, but that still asserts that there's objective meaning and objective goodness in life. Dworkin says that's his religion, and he thinks that's the religion of millions of other Americans, and I suspect that he's probably right about that. So in the last chapter, I ask whether this is sort of a viable way to go for the future. Could we have kind of a restoration of the ancient pagan city now along the lines of modern paganism of the immanent type of the Dworkin type? And I don't know the answer to that question, but I'm doubtful. And one of the aspects of it that I discussed that you just alluded to is that I don't know whether there's enough content in this sort of modern paganism or immanent religiosity to really do what religion needs to do. It, I think, tends not to be very demanding. It tends not to have public ceremonies, you know, rituals and so forth, you know, liturgy that, you know, can sustain people's, you know, religious devotion and faith and praise and commitment and so forth. And it tends to be fairly minimalist in its intellectual content, and possibly, at least my view would be, not very satisfying in its intellectual content as well. So
that's
I'm very
ironic, isn't it?
Exactly. So I mean, if I'm right about that, those are some pretty severe limitations in modern paganism.
I should say.
But
well,
you know,
Steve. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, there are other views, and I mean, if you want a more robust modern paganism, intellectually robust modern paganism, I mentioned a book called Confessions of a Born-Again Pagan by Anthony Cronman, former dean of the Yale Law School. This came out several years ago. And
he heartily endorsed your book. I saw that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think I appreciate his respect, his endorsement, and I have a great deal of admiration for him, too. His book is intellectually just magnificent. I think, you know, it's kind of a staggering achievement. It's about 1,200 pages long, too, by the way, you know.
Yeah.
But philosophically, it's just extremely rich. So you know, it's much more substantial, let's say, intellectually than Dworkin's very brief book, you know, or the Dworkin's book could be. In the end, I have the same doubts about it in these terms. I might just mention, so Tony Cronman actually came to a conference that we had here at University of San Diego about my book. And he was very generous and, I thought, extremely insightful in his contributions. But when we talked about his book, I raised these questions. I said, I don't understand, though, why your Spinoza type of paganism will be satisfying to anyone. I said, to traditional religious believers or Christians, it seems pretty empty. You know, there's no resurrection. There's no, you know, and so forth. And to traditional secularists, and most of the people at our conference, you know, were philosophers and probably were quite secular in their views, I don't see that it tells them anything either. I think it just tells us that what we already believe, now there's a sort of kind of reason, indwelling reason or necessity behind it. But what does that really give us that we didn't already have? And it was interesting because I think my sense was that most people in the room sort of agreed with that criticism, and that Tony Cronman himself said quite endearingly, I think, he said, sometimes I wonder whether I'm the only one who finds the only person who finds this satisfying. To me, it gives a lot, but it's true. Most people don't seem, on either the secular, let's say, or the religious side, don't seem to find much here, you know, that would respond to the sorts of needs and beliefs and commitments that religion, I think, tries to respond to. So there are different versions of paganism. I'm just skeptical whether paganism, let's say, will be any more successful now than it was really for ancient pagans once they became more philosophically sophisticated. I think ancient paganism ultimately became neo-paganism and neo-Platonism became kind of conduits for people like Augustine into Christianity. And I kind of wonder whether it's any more satisfactory today than it was then.
Well, Steve, I've taken up a lot of your time. I'd like to ask, you know, the traditional final question on the New Books Network, and that is, what are you working on now?
Oh, yeah. Well, I actually am working now on a book about authority. the tentative title is called Fictions, Lies, and the Authority of Law. And it takes off just as this book took off.
That's a great title, by the way.
I hope it'll be, you know, intriguing to some people. This book that we've been talking about takes off from the T.S. Eliot lectures. The authority book takes off from a statement made by Hannah Arendt in the 20th century when she said that authority has disappeared from the modern world. We no longer understand what it is. And this amounts to the loss of the groundwork of the world. So that's a pretty provocative claim. And I try to explore different aspects of it. Some of it is more conventional law stuff, constitutional interpretation, statutory interpretation, and so forth. But it comes around to a sort of an Augustinian reflection in the end. So there's a little bit of connection, I think, with the Pagans and Christians book.
Well, it sounds like you are, I know you're an incredibly productive scholar. So I will just thank you for writing this book, which I immensely enjoyed. And with that, I will just thank the scholar we've been talking to today, Stephen D. Smith, the author of the book Pagans and Christians in the City, Culture Wars from the Tiber to the Potomac. And thank you, listeners. And before we hang up, Steve, you need to hang on after I say bye-bye. But for now, I'll say thanks, Steve, and bye-bye to our listeners. See you again.
Thanks very much for the discussion.